Okay. Welcome everybody to Perry Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Penny Eiler, a member of the program committee. Perry aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic, religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or inabilities. Later in the service, we will invite visitors and guests and returning friends to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better, if you so choose. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They are presented either by a Prairie member, such as today, or by people from the wider community, or by our minister, Sandra Ingham. Our opening words today will be read by Barb Park.
This is a reading by E.E. Cummings. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping, greenly spirits of trees and the blue, true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. I, who have died, am alive again today, and this is the sun's birthday. This is the birthday of life and of love and wings and of the gay, great happenings, illimitable earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing, any, lifted from the no of all nothing, human merely being doubt, unimaginable you. Now the ears of my ears awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are open.
At this time, please welcome John, Rebecca, Indy, and Karen to light our chalice, after which we'll have a moment of silence.
I am?
For holy days on which we recall the old stories, we light the flame. For Passover, which reminds us of the courage and strength of those seeking freedom in the past, we light the flame. For Easter, which reminds us that love is our greatest challenge, we light the flame. For the opportunity to be together as a community, to remember the past, to plan the future, to be alive in our present, we light the flame.
At this time, we invite all the children and all of the children at heart and anybody who cares to share the story for all ages with Ann Pryor, our presenter today.
Hey, kids. Did anybody have an Easter egg hunt today yet?
I did.
Did you? How'd it go?
I don't know about it.
I hunted at my house and I found all 12. It was very exciting. So that's a tradition that we have at our house, and the story I'm going to kind of talk through, kind of read, is written by this woman. She is a friend of mine. She's an artist. Her name is Steffi. That's a nickname for Stephanie. And she lives in Wisconsin, in Mazomanie, Wisconsin. And she wrote a story about her traditions for Easter growing up in Croatia, a country in Europe. He and Robin found some bunny poo-poo. That's a terrific tradition. So Steffi grew up in a very poor part of Croatia. This is a painting she did of her farm house. And she had five brothers and sisters, and they lived in one of the poorest places in Croatia. As a kid, she didn't have enough food to eat, and she had one pair of boots all winter long. And all the brothers and sisters wore their own pair of boots, and by the springtime, there were holes in them, and the warm mud would squish up through the holes as they walked through their farmyard. There wasn't a whole lot of food left at the start of spring either. And they made all of their own things. Here's a painting that she did of her father making a broom for them to use at the house. So for the Croatian family, the Easter season was full of tradition and color and holy celebration. They started making preparations for Easter way back 40 days ago on Ash Wednesday, right? When they would fast, which means they wouldn't have a full meal every day. They would just have a little bit of food all that day. And then last week was Palm Sunday. On Palm Sunday, her grandmother would go outside and get a branch of flowers from the forsythia bush and take it to church where the priest would bless it, and grandma would come home and bring the blessings back to the house. And she would then take the branch and tuck it behind the painting of the Virgin Mary that hung on the wall and say, "May this blessed branch protect us from all evil." Another thing that they did in her village in Croatia was they lived by the bells. The bells would ring every hour to tell people the time. The bells would ring when somebody died to let people know it was time to be sad. The bells would ring when somebody was born or got married to say it's time to be happy. The bells would also ring if a storm was coming to warn people that they needed to, you know, to get ready. But during the 3 days right before Easter, they put covers on the bells so that they couldn't ring. And so now, from Thursday through Friday through Saturday, her town was very silent. It was oddly silent because no bells were ringing. The night before Easter, she and the other kids, while the adults were at church, she and the other kids would go to the hill and build this big pyramid for a bonfire. They had been collecting branches and brush and twigs and all this kind of burnable stuff and bringing it to the top of the hill for weeks because they wanted to have the biggest Easter bonfire that they could. All the villages around would be doing the same thing, and their village wanted to have the biggest one. So the kids got to be on the hill late at night getting the bonfire ready. And then tired, they would go home and sleep until about 4 o'clock in the morning on Easter morning, like today. And when it was still dark out, they would get up and go back to the hill. It was a little chilly, it was still dark, but they would all gather on the hill. There had been some teenagers who had stayed on the hill all night long to protect the bonfire, to make sure nobody started it before they should have, in case they were like pranksters. But at 4 a.m., they lit the fire and up it went. And it wasn't just theirs, it was on every hill all around. So she said it looked like fireflies all through the area. And the bells started ringing again. At 4 in the morning, the bells started ringing to announce that Jesus was reborn. So and the bells rang to awaken young and old to announce the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So even though they were tired, it was great. They went home. Her dad would cook a ham outside, and her grandma would bake bread, and all the kids would gather around a table while her mom made pisanika. And the pisanika are the special kind of egg. Here's all these kinds of eggs. Here, can you scooch back one little bit? Yeah, I'm gonna put these in the middle. Here are eggs made with wax and dyes. Here are eggs with paper glued to it to decorate them. But this kind of egg, and each of you can pass it around, you can feel it and pass it around if you want to, you don't have to. But this is wrapped with thread. Do you want to hold it and then pass it? Okay. So her mom would make those kinds of eggs, and each kid at the table got to pick which color threads they wanted on their egg, right? And so this is the one I want to hold for a second. So as her mom was making the eggs, she would take a thread that was about as long as her arm and start wrapping it around and making layers so that these patterns would happen. And see this diamond in the middle? She called that a God's eye. And so she would tell her children that God would always be with them and watching them. And so they had to be good. They shouldn't lie, they shouldn't swear, they shouldn't steal, because God would always watch them, just like here on the egg, right? And then, so once her mom made all the eggs, one for each of the six children, then they went and they played with them and they ate them. They didn't save them year after year because they didn't have a whole lot of food to eat, so they wanted to eat them. So what Steffi learned is that when her mom made works of art that would only last a little while, the children would admire them and play with the eggs for a bit, and then they would eat them. Looking back, I know that the process was far more important than the product. The annual Pisanika tradition, so full of our mother's pure love, became a timeless memory etched into the pages of my heart. So that's her Croatian Easter traditions. So now you guys are going to go downstairs, right? And is somebody... And I brought a special spring walking stick. It's a robin with an egg on its head. Who's going to lead all the kids down? And all right.
Yeah. All right. This morning's speaker, Ann Pryor, is a member here at Prairie. She was a devout Catholic growing up in her childhood in New York, and earnest Quaker during her peace activist days in Colorado, and is a Universalist leaning UU here in Madison. She became involved with Prairie UU Society when she read an ad for the job of Director of Religious Education. Eileen Nettleton was the RE chair that year, and the interview was at Pat Cotley's house. Prairie hired her the same year that the Society moved into this building, 1988. As DRE, and instituted things she is very happy to see continue today, such as Wild Wintering and Spring Fling, and the Mystery Friends program, originally called the Secret Friends, and the Singing Children Downstairs, though it was done with a different song. She and her husband Steve were delighted to raise their two children, Aaron and Alana, in this wonderful congregation, though Steve did it from afar, and left the DRE position in 1995 when she went to Cincinnati to conduct her PhD fieldwork. The subject of her research was Apparitions of the Blessed Mother, a partial topic for this morning's sermon, or service rather. Upon returning to Madison, she returned to Prairie as a member, then left for a few years to attend First Society with occasional forays to John Reed. She is now happily back at Prairie as a non-roving member and serves as a state folklorist based at the state's art agency, the Wisconsin Arts Board. An example of the work she does is an exhibit on display at the Dane County Regional Airport until May 10th. Wisconsin Folks, Masters of Tradition. And welcome in.
Thank you, Penny. Penny's been patient and gracious with. Thank you very much. When I was invited to do the service, it was because I've done work with miracles, and it's tough to get someone to do Easter Sunday here, I guess. So I'm going to talk about Marian apparitions and the special role that Wisconsin has in them, but I'm going to start with Easter, because it is Easter, and wind my way there. So I want you to hang in with me. We will get to the apparitions. I had wanted to tell the Easter story to the kids for the sake of cultural literacy, but it's a nasty story. There's betrayal, there is torture, there is political assassination. There's a lot of heavy stuff that comes first before the joyous, happy part that we're celebrating today, when Jesus returns from the dead, which is also pretty difficult to discuss. So I didn't. The Easter story is difficult for Christians, and it's nearly impossible for UUs to understand or accept as more than just a story. But because of that, Easter invites us to wrestle with difficult issues. The one I'm going to focus on today is death and what happens after death.
The Easter story invites us to examine what Christianity offers as ideas of what happens after death. And that's my intention, to share some things I've been thinking about lately on a personal level, trying to understand them, and then think about the Catholic community believers that I worked with for my research, who have a very different way of interpreting things than I do, but still inform my thinking. So to start off on the personal level, I recently had the troubled but privileged experience of being with my father-in-law as he died. In a North Carolina hospice, as he lay dying, I looked for that bit of himself, that spark of personality and intelligence, that animating spirit that had made him uniquely Art Ackerman. It seemed gone from his physical body that was just laying there, not seeming able to stop breathing. I was brought to a space in which it was impossible to not consider one of life's great questions. What is this thin separation between the here and now and the there and then? The Easter story suggests that extraordinary individuals like Jesus who are able to cross that divide. So here is someone who was completely dead, not like in The Princess Bride where the hero was only mostly dead, and yet he returned in a way that where he could be seen and heard by people. Current research by Bill Guggenheim and Judy Guggenheim, they interviewed over 3,000 people, collected narratives from common folk who, like the apostles and the women at the tomb, experienced some kind of communication from a deceased family or friend. Extraordinary instances of the loved one communicating with them came about in one or more ways, and these included sensing a presence, and this was the most common thing reported, or hearing a voice, either externally or internally, feeling a touch, smelling a fragrance, possibly the person's cologne, or flowers, especially roses, seeing something, whether it's fully developed or partially developed, or seeing the person, him or herself, receiving a telephone call from the deceased, experiencing an inexplicable physical phenomena like the lights flickering on and off, or other appliances like the radio turning on when they shouldn't, or things getting turned over, or having some kind of symbolic experience, especially if the person has asked for a sign from the deceased person to know that they're okay. So, two examples. One, a story I heard recently, and then another that I experienced myself. Oh, and you see my shirt?
I'm
just in case.
I'm wearing a Mary t-shirt.
So a month ago, a colleague at UW told me that she and her husband had recently returned to Ohio to attend the funeral of his uncle. At the memorial service, there was a clock that sat on the casket, and which was unusual. This was not a typical Amish tradition. So when they asked about it, the clock had stopped exactly at the moment when the man had died. And so the family placed it there because they understood that as a message of some sort. For this. Also, another phenomenon that happened exactly at the moment when he died was that a door blew open. That shouldn't have blown open. For myself, a few years ago, after my sister-in-law died quite unexpectedly and far too young in a traffic accident, her husband and her mother separately both saw her in their bedrooms, in their respective bedrooms. I did not see her, but I had the experience of, we each got to take something of hers when we left to go home, and I took a sweater that I wanted to bring to my office to wear in case I got chilly during the day. I hung it on the back of my office chair. One by one, the buttons popped off that sweater. Not from use, just from hanging there. I interpreted this as a type of communication from her. This is a personal interpretation. I have not been provided guidance from my society in how to understand such an experience. I am a seeker. Marian apparitions might be thought of as another example of this type of phenomenon. It's a bit different because the spirit communicating with the living, Mary, has been dead for a long time. She hasn't recently deceased. And Catholics have a framework honed and shaped by 2,013 years of collective experience. So what this framework is, and it'll describe what I mean by a Marian apparition. This is when Mary, the Blessed Mother, the Virgin Mary, appears to a living person. The seer or visionary is typically an ordinary person, someone without specialized training, knowledge, and sometimes not even with devotion to Mary. The new visionary is typically confused and frightened by the otherworldly experience and turns to family, friends, or a priest for help. If word spreads, and especially if Mary promised to return at a set time and place, people start to gather. So was born a public Marian apparition, something that started as a personal supernatural experience, but has become a community event. Some serial apparitions end within days, others carry on for decades. Even after they end, believers may continue to come to the now sacred site, which probably now has a shrine erected on it as well. This is the case in both of the Wisconsin sites of focus today, in Champion, or Champion. In Lower Door County, this is in the Belgian settlement area, the shrine is Our Lady of Good Help, also known simply as the chapel. The story of the Champion visionary fits perfectly with the idealized model framework of a Marian apparition that has grown up over the centuries within Catholicism. The visionary was a young woman, Adele Bryce, an immigrant from Belgium, uneducated, devout, humble. The year was 1859, the month was October, and it was one year after the Marian apparitions at Lourdes, France, which had become very important in Catholic belief. So as the story has come down through time, here's the story of Adele's experience with Mary. She was going to the grist mill about 4 miles away from Champion with a sack of wheat on her head. As Adele came near the place, she saw a lady all in white standing between two trees, one a maple, the other a hemlock. Adele was frightened and stood still. The vision slowly disappeared, leaving a white cloud after it. Adele continued on her errand and returned home without seeing anything more. She told her parents about what happened and they tried to puzzle it out. On the following Sunday, she had to pass here again on her way to Mass at Bay Settlement, about 11 miles from her home. This time, her sister and a neighbor woman were with her. When they came near the trees, the same lady in white was at the place where Adele had seen her before. Adele was again frightened. After Mass, Adele told her confessor how she had been frightened at the sight of the lady in white. He bade her not to fear, advised her that if it were a heavenly messenger, she would see it again, and it would not harm her, and she should ask in God's name who it was and what it desired of her. So as they approached the place again, Adele saw this lady, dazzling white clothing, a yellow sash around her waist, a crown of stars around her head. Adele followed her confessor's instructions, and the vision answered, "I am the Queen of Heaven." When news spread about Adele Bryce's vision of the Blessed Virgin, most people believe, this is from their account, this is still part of the story, this is not my words. Most people believed the account and were astonished. Some considered the event a demented delusion. Because of what the vision had told her, Adele interpreted it as a commission to catechize children in the area and admonish the sinners of the Bay Settlement. So now, my words. As an apparition continues to unfold, Catholics in the community decide whether to believe or not in its authenticity. To do this, they turn to both official and popular means of discernment. In the rare event that the local bishop launches an investigation, would-be believers can wait for that judgment, but as we saw in the case of Champion, it took 150 years for that to happen, which is not atypical. The church moves slowly. And so, an aside, those of us who might be waiting for big changes in the Catholic Church because of the new pope, it's a slow institution. All right, so most often, though, people trying to figure out whether they should believe or not, they turn to their own criteria. If this apparition compares well with the few others that have been approved by the church, if they experience direct signs from heaven themselves about this, if reputable priests support the visionary, and if the messages Mary delivers to the visionary seem aligned with church teachings. They also rely on narrative, the personal experience stories that they hear from others about the apparitions and the good outcomes. Many legends about Mary's direct intervention are retold through this discernment process. Apparitions also produce messages. When Mary visits a person, she does so to deliver a warning or a teaching. The shape of her messages varies because of the filter of each visionary, and the tone can range from apocalyptic to comforting. All the messages share a sense of urgency and an impulse towards reform. Examining apparition messages can reveal the worries felt by Marian devotees of the time, most of whom are typically politically conservative. For example, Marian apparition messages from the 1950s are concerned with the threat of godless communism, while those from the late 1990s deal more with millennial fears, end of the century, end of the world. The act of a Catholic woman, and now we get into the sexual politics related to this. The act of a Catholic woman publicly revealing words that come directly from heaven and go around the intermediary of ordained clergy has the potential to be subversive. But these visionaries are typically Orthodox Catholics who willingly acquiesce to a role of obedience to their superiors. In Adele Bryce's case, and with many other approved visionaries in the 19th and early 20th century, they become nuns. So they become safely contained within an arm of the church in which obedience and deference is valued. Because her story so classically fits within the Catholic Church's framework for authentic supernatural experiences of a divine origin, the Bishop of Green Bay, and there had to be other reasons too, but the Bishop of Green Bay launched a review of the events in 2009. The commission found everything to be in order and that multiple good fruits had come from the devotion there over the past 150 years. So in December 2010, he approved the claims which made Champion, the apparition, the very first and the very only one approved by the Catholic Church in the United States. This is a big deal. This is a huge deal. In rural, tiny, isolated little Champion, you know, in southern Door County. So that case stands in sharp contrast to the case of Nisida. So beginning in 1950, Marianne Van Hoof, a farm wife and mother of eight in central Wisconsin, this is Juneau County, it's right by Mauston if you go up the interstate, she started to experience a series of visions of Marianne. She had eight that first year. Word spread, as did great excitement. Finally, this was our own Fatima. There had been no claim like this. It made the cover of Life magazine. It was a very big deal. On August 15, 1950, over 100,000 people came to Nisida to witness the promised miracle of the sun. People came from 40 states in buses, trains, and cars. Some people claim they saw nothing. Others claim to see the sun spin or seemingly fall to earth. This is a pattern. This is what happened at Fatima. So again, it was reliving on American soil what had happened at the apparitions in Fatima, which were approved. Others saw a cross in the sun. Some saw the sun change colors. Rosaries that people were holding changed colors also. So here are all of these inexplicable physical phenomena caused by the presence of a spirit. But Marianne Van Hoof was no Adele Bryce. Three different bishops of La Crosse over the years have convened commissions to investigate the claims of her apparitions, and all three repeatedly denied the validity of those claims. In 1955, again in 75, and again in 1998. One reason is that Van Hoof did not display the proper level of obedience to priests and church officials. She felt called by these messages. She went in one direction, and they did not approve of that direction. Also, her background as a practicing spiritualist diminished her veracity in the eyes of the church. She was a convert into Christianity from a spiritualist background. There was similarity between Van Hoof's reported messages from Mary and speeches from Senator Joseph McCarthy's anti-communist campaign. He was her senator, based in Appleton, Wisconsin, not too far from Nisida. And then Van Hoof's messages grew increasingly incoherent over the years, getting actually pretty wacky. While the official church denied Van Hoof's claims, hundreds of Catholic pilgrims to Nisida continued to go, and they expressed their belief in the apparitions through testimonials. There are at least two books of collected testimonials. Many wrote of the supernatural experiences that they had had themselves or witnessed with others. Many cited the tremendous feeling of peace that they had experienced there, implying that that could only come about through the presence of a divine being. Some testified that the great positive changes in the spiritual lives of pilgrims was proof enough of the apparition's validity. These opposing results in discernment created a tremendous schism in the local community itself and then also within the Catholic community, and is still seen today by posted signs on the door of the Nicaea Catholic Church warning not to believe in the Van Hoof apparitions or to participate in any of the devotional activities there. In such a case as this, when the church actually rules on an apparition, Catholics are required to follow the dictates of the hierarchy, even if this contradicts their own understandings of the event. Otherwise, belief in apparitions is optional. These Catholics, too, are seekers. If the church approves the apparition claims, you are not required to believe in it, but you can. Or if the church ignores the apparition claims, which is the most likely outcome, again, you are free to believe in it or not. So they, like us, are seekers. So communication from the other side of that thin veil separating life and death. How is it possible? What does it mean? What does it imply about life after death? It's part of the mystery we've yet to solve. But I am glad to be here on the road with my fellow seekers in Prairie, exploring ideas as we support each other on our individual searches and collective searches for truth and meaning. And that's it. I rushed through that. Right, so they really are touch points for the moment in time in which they occur. If you go to Nicaea, it is stuck in the 1950s and 60s. If you read the signage, it's concerned about the length of skirts for women, for instance, you know, because that was the day of mini skirts. It's very much of the moment. Those that have a more universal message are going to fare better in the in the winnowing and sifting of it. And then related to, I would love to delve more deeply into the Champion apparition, because why did this bishop even go back in 2009? There's been a real conservative turn in the Catholic Church under John Paul II. Most of the new seminarians coming in are very conservative men. Most of the bishops who have been appointed are very conservative. So I'm assuming that one of the motivations of this bishop in Green Bay is that conservative leaning and the reformist message that comes out of that shrine, you know, works towards that end. And he probably also has a very strong devotion to Mary. So that's probably part of it. But I don't have those answers, and it's really interesting to me because, you know, kind of, you know, from being on the outside, it felt like, oh my God, out of the blue, you know, because there was no extraordinary activity going on there. This has been a place of devotion for the Belgians of Lower Door County for generations. Annual events, anniversary events. Now it's going to become a site of pilgrimage. To a greater degree, it is going to change that community in a touristic sense. And they are, in fact, changing. Some of the changes, better bathrooms, more bathrooms, more resident clergy to hold mass more frequently, you know, a bigger gift shop, things like that, a better parking lot, you know, lots of infrastructure changes, not just increased devotional activity. My folklorist buddies in Chicago took me to that underpass, and we saw the salt stain and the devotional space that had grown up around it. And what was fascinating was when you looked at it, you had to use your imagination to really see Mary. But you know, it was that kind of oval kind of portrait, kind of profile silhouette. But what was fascinating was that the young people were looking at it through their cell phones. They were taking photos with their cell phones of this. And when you did that, It condensed the image and you could see it really clearly. It became much more defined. And how that was interpreted by the folks there is that Mary is talking to the youth. This image on the wall is not for us old folks. It is for the youth who are going to be looking at it through their cell phones, and she will use any means necessary to make her message known, which was such a cool interpretation, a meaning of that action. Yeah. I'll tell you, the Nisida apparition birthed one that was in Bayside, Queens for a long time. Veronica Lukin, they met at the former Vatican Pavilion in Bayside, Queens at the old World Fairground there for years. So that was kind of like the next generation one. There's the one that I studied in Cincinnati where there were three visionaries and five sites and kind of a complicated setup. There's one in, I think it's Belleville, Illinois. Colorado, they are there. And there is, in fact, a Pilgrim's Guide to Marian Sites in the U.S., you know, published by a devotional publisher. So they are the Ohio. I visit some in Ohio, up by Cleveland. They're everywhere. and in this kind of continuum from you know, full-blown apparition, which is the most rare, to something special that happened there. Or for what was interesting, there was a pamphlet published by three of the Wisconsin Catholic bishops in 2012. They named 2012 as a year of pilgrimage, and they named three approved sites within Wisconsin to go to. Nisida was not one of them, but the Shrine of Our Lady of Good Help in Champion, also known as Robinsonville, and then it has a different address, city attached to its mailing address, so it's kind of confusing. But that was one of them. Hubertus, it's high on a hill, beautiful, tall church. It's a site of pilgrimage. Discalced Carmelite monks are there. That site, and then the Shrine for Our Lady of Guadalupe over in La Crosse. Those were the three that were approved by the bishops of Green Bay, Milwaukee, and La Crosse. They each got one. The bishop from Madison obviously did not participate in this, not sure why, but there is a favorite Marian gathering place off of Cottage Grove, Schoenstatt. It's a special kind of devotion to Mary. It's not a site of apparition, but it's a devotional site pretty close by. So there have been Jungian analyses of that. There's been, you know, feminist analyses of that. And it's exactly addressing what you're talking about, compensating for that missing fourth element. They've got the Trinity, but four is really the, you know, the more complete rounding number, and that fourth would be a female. I had a thought, and it is gone. Many of the devotees, so the folks that I interview, for instance, who go to these, relate to Mary as a mother. They might be having problems with their children. They are women. They see her as a fellow on this path of motherhood, and turn to her for help as a parent, as a fellow parent. So it's like a support group, you know, in a way. My own mother, whose name is Mary, and who was married to a man named Joseph, they had six kids. It was really interesting. She would say that she never had that relationship with Mary. Very devout Catholic, but she never had that relationship, and kind of felt guilty. Catholic, kind of felt guilty for not. But it speaks to some and not to all. But what I love looking at is the iconography in places. So technically, Jesus on the cross or Jesus risen is supposed to be the main image in a church. Sometimes Mary kind of replaces him, and you know, then you wonder, okay, what are the dynamics here when this church got built that happened? Usually she's off to the side altar because she, you know, has to follow this kind of pyramid
leveling.
So it comes out in lots of interesting ways. The visionary typically is female, not exclusively, but typically. Back in the 19th century, they were often young. That wasn't the case in the 20s, at least the latter half of the 20th century. It was married people, which was pretty unusual. It was adults, which was pretty unusual. But it is pretty common that it is a female seeing this and hearing this. And in terms of the others, the written text, you know, the Bible itself, both the Judaic Old Testament and then the New Testament, the Christian New Testament, they are filled with stories of angels coming, with God talking directly to Moses, with prophets having heard the word of the Lord and then passing it on to others. This is not a new dynamic. It's not a new trope. It's a continuation of that, but it's taken this very special form. One thing I wonder is it really Mary? Or is that the framework that of interpretation that is easiest for the visionary to understand? Or is it some other spirit from the Catholic pantheon, you know, that they recognize, that they don't recognize, but they name as Mary? So that's something interesting that I wonder about sometimes. Often devotions to saints, a saint will help and aid the person coming in request, but it's of a different assistance. It's helping me find my lost keys or helping me sell my house. I'm not kidding, very practical help. Helping me get better from this illness. But it's not like they come and you see them. It's really Mary and Jesus doing that. Yeah. When I was in Cincinnati, I was attending I attended one Quaker church. I attended the UU church there, St. John's. And there was a UFO fellow there who really wanted to engage me in that conversation. And, you know, I just had enough other stuff to pay attention to it. And so I've never really gone into that. There are more psychological studies now about, you know, life after death experiences, that going down the tunnel, no, it really is this part of your brain showing you something. Many of these visionaries submit themselves to physical and psychological tests because they are so secure in their belief that they are willing to be tested, and then they make a video of it. You see the woman just wired up and charts and graphs over here. It's, you know, so they're using science on the behalf of religion to defend this very odd occurrence. You know, and if you don't already believe, you're not going to be convinced by that. But if you already believe, it's just one more step down the road to, you know, strengthening it.
Okay, I think we have to stop the questions, but I'm sure Anne will be around here after the service, and you can talk to her about them.
Thank you, Anne. K.K. Anderson will close the service with a closing word.
Our closing words are from Diego Valeri, not someone that I'm familiar with, but he's in our book. You who have an eye for miracles, regard the bud now appearing on the bare branch of the fragile young tree. It's a mere dot on nothing, but already it's a flower, already a fruit, already its own death and resurrection.
Thank you for coming. Please extend the hand of friendship to those around you. And join us for brunch afterwards, and help yourself to any stray candy or peeps. Come on.